loud.
I really don't understand your question. I don't know if I can't hear or you guys can't talk in the mic or whatever.
Get crazy.
You go find them, you throw your arms around them, you give them a big kiss on the mouth if you're a girl.
Get nuts.
Get up, baby. Get up. Oh, yeah, it's gone.
It's the Cube Show.
This is All Born Radio.
I'm a good person.
Man, y'all take it easy down there on the off, baby.
God want us to win the world championship.
You're doing it wrong. You're doing the wrong things.
Is anybody else tired or is it just me?
Hey, legitimate question, though.
Okay.
I'm drunk right now.
Wow.
Another one!
I!
And now, Cole Kublick.
He is bad Auburn man.
Clock here on the Cube Show. Actually, 8:01 and 13 seconds on the Cube Show. Just want to send a quick congratulations out to some of our ticket winners.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. Kenny Moore got in. So did Ben Johnson and David S. Fleming as well. Got a chance to win tickets to see Steve Renazzisi, who will be in here in about an hour live at Stand Up Live this weekend. They're going to see them tomorrow night. Tomorrow is your last chance to win tickets. We will have tickets to give away for Saturday's show. I think we may have two pair to be able to give away for that Saturday show. I'll have to check with Lucy and see if we can. But you'll be able to win that tomorrow on the Cube Show, which, by the way, on these shows, I'll be doing guest sets. That's right. You'll be able to see me do a handful of minutes of El Comedy.
Wow.
I may have a joke about the guy who is a registered sex offender.
Oh, stop.
From early in the show. Man, that's a good joke. I didn't even throw that in with earlier.
No, you got it in. I think you're ruining some people's day.
No, stop. Stop. The jokes are great. Tickets, by the way.
If you missed getting physical at 6:40, go download the podcast after the show. It's a pretty good story.
If you want tickets to go see it and you weren't able to win or you don't think you'll be able to win, they're really, really, really affordable. It's a great date night. Go to standuplive.com and you can see me. Cole, right?
Yeah.
One day we're going to get you to do stand-up on that stage.
Why?
I don't know. I think it would be super fun.
Okay.
Get you to do, like, 5 minutes? You think you do 5 minutes of comedy?
I mean, I could. I don't know how good it would be. Right. It's not going to be fun.
Well, that's the whole point. It's supposed to be fun for us. We're supposed to laugh.
Yeah, it would be fun for you, but not for me. No, because it probably wouldn't be... I'd probably just try to cuss and...
How much effort you got to put into cussing?
And make fun of myself.
So, like, this is the chance I can actually cuss. Can't cuss on radio, can't cuss on TV, but I can cuss on stage.
So we had to redo our cold question of the day. It's back up now. Terrell Lewis. What did we say? Terrell Smith last time?
Yeah. He changed his name from Hall to Lewis. We just misspoke.
Deshaun Hand, Christian Miller, Rashawn Evans. So... no one is leading that poll at the moment because they're all 0%. Yeah, we had to redo it.
Even though we adjusted the name, I still think Rashawn Evans is going to be the guy. I think I looked at it right before we adjusted it. I think I saw that Deshaun Hand was leading the poll, like barely. It was like 34 to 33%. I think it was close. It was close. I think number two was Rashawn Evans on that.
Yeah, Deshaun Hand was number one. And Mark Burnett seems pretty confident that he can – sort of have that breakout year. I wonder if he's good. My question for Deshaun Hand is, can he find a home? Because I don't know if, you know, he's kind of in that Jonathan Kongbo situation where I think he's a little too big to be an edge defensive end, mm-hmm. you know, to be a guy who can really hurt you off the edge. Don't know if he's quick enough. Don't know if he's fast enough. I mean, he's pretty limber for his size, but – is he one of those guys that will welcome being bumped down inside? And I think the thing that people forget, and maybe they don't forget it because they never knew it, because maybe people never heard him do interviews, or maybe people were never fortunate enough to have a conversation with him. But Jonathan Allen and Ryan Anderson and Dalvin Tomlinson, it's not just what they were able to do with their hands or their technique or how strong they were, or how quick they were off the edge. You just don't come around guys with that kind of mindset very often. the mental makeup of those dudes was rare. I think Reuben Foster, same way. It's not saying that this wave of players isn't talented, doesn't have ability, but the way that they were, the kind of guys that they were mentally, that's uncoachable. You don't create that. You don't practice that into someone. You don't rep it. There aren't drills that make you want to be the kind of guys that those guys were. And what we don't know, and granted, I'm not ruling it out, but I am saying that it's an uncertainty that there will be those kind of guys up front. Now, we can erase Daron Payne from this conversation because he is elite and he is a dude. And we've seen him not only take up blocks, but run people over. We've seen him stuff the run. We've seen him rush the passer. We've seen him collapse the pocket. He can do it all. He is not of any concern to me heading into this season. But who's going to be the other guy opposite him in the middle of that defense? And who's going to be able to affect the edge and play the edge, not just in pass situations? Because following up on what Denzel Duvall and Dylan Lee and guys like that did, Ryan Anderson was elite against the run as well. And when Jonathan Allen kicked out, he was elite against the run as well. So it's not just can you get a Tim Williams that can rush the passer off the edge like his hair's on fire, but this guy's got to play the run too. And I think when you talk about this defense being deeper and having more depth, that's great. And offenses are going to continue to go fast. And you're going to continue to need to plug guys in. But was depth a concern for that defense last year?
I don't remember being so.
We bring it up because of the Clemson game. And it looked like a couple guys were gassed late in that game.
Because you played 99 plays.
I didn't hear one other person mention one thing about Alabama's front seven depth the rest of the year. Any other game. 14 out of 15 games, not one person made one mention. Oh, boy, guys, this front seven depth, guys.
Little thin here. Thin.
I know they got 87 knots this year, but have you seen the depth? Wait till that depth catches up with them. No one was saying that. Nobody. Now, part of that was because they put themselves in position in most games that it didn't matter.
Sure, and I don't know who you can play in the entire world of college football where going against 99 plays wouldn't create some kind of issue for you.
Now, what about the other part of if the defense is deeper, okay. I don't think deeper means better. We've talked about that. Just like returning starter doesn't mean better. Sometimes it's not a good thing if a guy's coming back in a returning starter because he wasn't good the year before. And that doesn't mean he's going to be good the next year.
Yeah, you could have 3 7s lined up behind each other, but is that better than a 10 and a 9?
How many of these offenses will be better this year? Tough to say that Florida State's offense is going to be better. You lost some weapons on the perimeter, and you lost, I'm going to say it, the best running back in school history.
Wow.
That's including Pooh Bear Williams.
Wow. I can't believe you put Pooh Bear in there.
And Dan Kendra.
Yes.
So all of them.
Somehow got past Dan Kendra.
Fresno State, Colorado State, who cares? Vanderbilt's offense should be better. I mean, Kyle Shermer continue to grow. Andy Ludwig still the coordinator. You got the school's all-time leading rusher in Ralph Webb. Now, I'm not saying Vanderbilt's going to really challenge Alabama, but, I mean, that's an offense that they're going to have to be ready to play. They're not going to be able to sleepwalk through that game. The Ole Miss offense should be better. They got weapons everywhere. That offensive line has a chance to make big strides because Greg Little can play, Javon Patterson can play, Jordan Sims can play. Texas A&M, no, not going to be better. Might end up being pretty good, but not going to be better than they were last year with Trevor Knight and Ricky Seals-Jones and some of those guys they lost. They lost some dudes, no. I don't think Arkansas is going to be better. I know I'm getting a lot of hate mail for that. I get it. Doesn't mean the quarterback can't be good.
By the way, I should mention, if you have hate mail, send it to WUMP Care of Cole Kublik, 1717 Highway 72, Athens, Alabama.
Who's testing that
for anthrax?
Yes.
That would be me, actually. I'm the anthrax tester.
Good.
LSU, so if I'm not here one day, you know you got mail.
LSU offense better? Good chance.
Yeah,
maybe have a semblance of balance this year?
But we say better. Darius Geis was in for a long time last year. If the quarterback makes improvements, maybe.
My point in that their offense is better this year is that it's not just the running back, whoever it is.
Well, let's hope so.
Mississippi State's offense better? I think the offensive line is going to be better. They might not have the weapons, but if they can shore up the drops, I think that offense is better. Fitzgerald can grow a little bit. Mercer's offense, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Auburn offense can be better. So part of will this defense be better than last year's defense could hinge on how good are the offenses. Are the majority of the offenses that you're going to play going to be better? But I don't necessarily believe that being deeper just equates to being better. Now, does it give you more options? And does it force guys to compete more for their job? And does it mean that better players are probably going to be on the field instead of just having to put a guy in who's talented because he's all you have? Yeah. And there's some all-time greats on that defense last year. And I just don't – I'm not saying there's going to be a severe drop-off. I'm not saying Bama's losing four games. But telling me the front seven's going to be better because it's deeper?
That was an all-time
– I apologize.
All-time.
I cannot allow that on this show that gives you facts and opinions. I'm sorry. Let's get to 10 after tweets.
Bring me the tweets!
Coming up after the break, James Spady of Alabama A&M will be in studio hanging out with us.
Following my latest tweets at Cube Show, what's your theory on why Alabama has such a difficult time getting a quality field goal kicker?
Okay.
Is it an evaluation or salary cap issue?
Oh, come on. Probably salary cap. Ain't got a lot to spend on the old kicking position.
I would have no idea where to even – how would you even begin to describe why there hasn't been a great kicker? And let me just say this.
Transfers? They're not kicker you?
Have the kickers been as bad as we're making them out to be? I don't know. I'd have to go look at the numbers. But
they've been bad in big moments. They have had issues in big moments. But if you look over the last 3 or 4 years,
like
as far as overall numbers,
the one kid missed a bunch against Arkansas. Was that Saban's first year in Fayetteville when he missed the extra points?
No one discusses Saban's first year. We never.
Yeah,
talked about
that's why all
that.
The stats that I put out yesterday started in 08. That's like AS after Saban.
Yeah.
BS doesn't count.
Every national championship before Saban was BS. Is that what you're saying? I hear what you're saying as somebody who played at Auburn, and I don't appreciate it. By the way, Head Coach and the Nick Saban Show debuts tonight at 6:30 on the Up, so get excited about that.
Dan Strickland tweets, at Cole Kublik doing comedy would devolve into R.A. Cole talking Tecmo Bowl smack in like 35 seconds.
Yeah, maybe, so just come out and see me do it tonight instead. Tonight or Friday or Saturday.
Dan Strickland also tweets, I do recall preseason 2016 many pundits saying the Bama D-line was not as deep as 2015, but that 15 line depth was ridiculous. And what happened? The 16 line wasn't as deep, but they were really, really good.
But we saw a lot from Tim, at least on this show, we saw a lot from Tim Williams that we liked going into last year. We knew about Jonathan Allen. And the violent hands, as Cole liked to talk about it. I mentioned that at least 100,000 times in the show.
Ryan Anderson got a lot of reps. Tomlinson got some reps.
And maybe the show is just better than everybody. That's why we went Abby's. But we talked about them being pretty darn stout. That there was a lot to like about them.
Here's the last thing that
my main concern was like going to a new defensive coordinator, which did not seem to be an issue.
Here's the last thing that I'm going to say about it.
Or I think a defensive line coach is my fault.
These dudes that everyone's excited about this year, they haven't wowed me. That's all I'm going to say. They haven't wowed me.
That's fair.
So, We'll talk with James Spady
about wowing, Bama.
That opener against UAB week one. Next, he joins us in studio.
WUMP Sports Radio. The op.
America.
All right, welcome back in Cube Show, Sports Radio 730 and 103.9 The Ump. Excited to have James Spady, head coach of the Alabama A&M Bulldogs, in studio. Coach, how's camp going so far?
I was just telling Arky, we're having a really good camp right now. I'm, you know, as a coach, you're never satisfied.
Sure.
And I'm not. I mean, we got a bunch of things that we need to get better at. But right now, you know, if I had to kind of categorize things, I'd say we got 100% buy-in from our football team. And, you know, coaches, that's really all we can ask for. These guys really understand what we're asking of them, and they're giving it every day. We've had great practices, and I feel really good about where we're going.
Is that what's sort of – if you had a checklist of things that would signify a good camp for you – is kids buying in maybe number one? Staying healthy would probably be up there. You know, guys doing what they're told as far as showing up on time, being at the right place on time, no extracurricular activities, fights at practice, and, you know, fights in the locker room, things of that nature. But what are some of the things that would be towards the top of your list?
I mean, you just – that's the list right there is what you said. You know, as a coach, you're looking – you're trying to mark your progress. You're trying to find out where you are. Especially during this time of year where you've got so many I's to dot and T's to cross. We've got to get ready for UAB. We've got to put together a long-term plan for the season. And so there are a lot of I's to dot and T's to cross. And so what you look for every day is for guys to come out with the right attitude. And attitude is everything. You look for them to come out with a mindset of preparation. And that's a big thing that we talk about every day. You need to come to practice with a purpose. Don't come out here and go through the motions and try to survive from day to day. And when I say we've got 100% buy-in, I haven't heard a complaint, not one, about a guy who is, you know, it's hot out here or, you know, my ankle's a little sore. And
well, there's no two-a-days anymore, so he shouldn't be complaining about anything.
You know, you and I are old school, man. And, you know, that was part of the kind of the rite of passage. But let me give some credit to Lonnie Brown, our strength conditioning coordinator, and Ronnell Butler and Norman Jones. Those guys do a fantastic job, and they spent the summer with about 70 of our football players here all summer, and they really kind of sent the message that, hey, look, guys, if you're running around complaining, you're not improving. If you're running around dealing with issues, then you're not improving, and the mental toughness on our football team is 180 degrees.
I'm glad you brought up UAB. Arky and I mentioned this earlier in the show.
Oh, did I bring up UAB?
You did. And it's the opener, so it's fine. That's your first game. You're not looking past anybody, so it's all right to talk about it. But it's such an intriguing matchup to me because I understand scouting. I understand preparation. And I feel like we've talked to our listeners enough about how that works and how that operates that they have a pretty decent understanding. There is no team to scout.
No, right.
There is no tendencies to look at. There are not guys, not even so much from a formation, a play calling at certain parts of the field, but an individual tendencies to look at. How do you even go about, I understand how you're going to handle yourself. How do you even go about preparing for a team that hasn't been a team?
So I mean, you just outlined how tough it is. You know,
it's almost impossible.
Yeah, it really is, and people don't understand the gravity of that. So, there's a couple layers now. The first game of the season is always, you know, you've had all spring and all summer.
Such a feeling out process.
And so the first game of the season is always kind of tough to figure out. What direction is this football team going to go? What do we need to prepare for? What
are the things that we need? Communication is so difficult.
Yeah, but then the first game ever, you know, I mean, not just the first game of the season. But, you know, they're coming from zero. If they had played last season, maybe we could look at the tendencies from last season. Maybe we could look at, you know, what their comfort zones were last season. But they don't have a last season. And so that makes it tough. You know, I do know that, you know, we've played them before. Coach Clark was the head football coach then. And so we'll go back and study some of those things and see if there's some, you know, hopefully there's some carryover. You know, just trying to get a bead on whether or not they're going to be what they were before. I mean, it makes you a little uncomfortable. But sure. You also hit the nail on the head. There's a bigger concern right there in Normal. We got to worry about Alabama A&M and doing the things right that we should be doing right.
And it's a much bigger challenge for them than it will be for you, because you have at least a nucleus, a foundation of players who have been on the field together and understand what being in a game is going to be like, and being in that huddle together, making checks, things of that nature. I kind of jokingly with Arky earlier in the show said, I would imagine that's going to be a lot of base defense early and then a lot of, you know, base plays on offense, in that you can check it left or right, and it gives you a little extra time at the line of scrimmage to sort of decipher what you see.
I'm sure Coach Clark is listening, so come on.
That's all right.
Don't
no,
give him a game
plan. He listens to those shows down in Birmingham. It's all right.
But you're absolutely right. We as a matter of fact, the theme of this training camp has been, hey, guys, keep your knees bent and keep your head on a swivel, because things could change any second. And you know how football is. I mean, you go into the game plan – or excuse me, you go into a game with a game plan. And you've got – and then all of a sudden the first series and you're like, they didn't do anything we expected them to do. And your game plan is – pretty sure. much null and void, right? So you have to make these adjustments, and that's football. That's the way it works. And so we've been talking to the guys about, hey, be ready to make the adjustment.
Will you change anything from a communication standpoint? Because it could be so much more different in this game than it has been in other games you've played.
Yeah, and we're making those adjustments now. Communication on the defensive side is so important, just to make sure guys are on the same page all the time. And even if in the middle of a play you have to make an adjustment, and then on the offensive side of the ball as well, that comes from the quarterback position. But from the coaches to the players, you know, our system is our system. And I'm not going to make any changes there. I'm pretty comfortable with the way we communicate from us to them. But what we are tweaking is the way our players communicate to one another and make the adjustments that we talked about on the sideline.
Staying with fall camp, you and I joke about no two-a-days, and it's different than when you played than when I played. And it's always going to be like that through the timeline of college football. It's always going to be more difficult back then. How has it changed your preparation this offseason, having an extended period of practice before the first game and not really being able to bunch more practices into certain days?
It's really interesting from a calendar and planning perspective, because, you know, you've got to make sure you still get 29 practice opportunities before your first game. So what you've got to do is you've got to try and space that out so that you don't wear out your football team. But you want them to be at their peak conditioning when you start the season, and you also are trying to condition for a season, not necessarily for a game. And so what we chose to do, we had a choice this year, and we chose to take the extra time, take the extra week, because we would get extra time walking through and meeting and actually being a classroom football team, a learning football, learning situations. We do a lot of situational football, put guys in scenarios that we expect them to be in on Saturday. And having extra time to do that, really kind of makes me feel a little bit better. I can make sure I check off all the boxes. Did I cover this? Did I cover that? Well, we've got time to cover that this evening. So from that standpoint, it's been great. Not having two-a-days, you know, I'm old school, man. I'm like you. I remember going – you know, as freshmen, we would have an extra week on campus before the vets got there, and we'd practice three times a day, man. And it did you really well physically. You were able to build your bodies. But, you know, you get worn out now, man, and there's so many other stimuli. You got so many other things that these guys have to deal with on a daily basis. And so, I don't know. It's the way things are going. I'm still old school in my thinking, but it's the way things are going. And I think I like this routine that we did this summer a little bit better.
Because I tried to explain to our listeners that I know a lot of people, when they hear two-a-days, they just think, oh, it's pounding and pounding and pounding. But in reality, what it should be, and I think what it is most places, not all, but what it is most places, it's not Junction Boys where you're getting out there and just running guys into the ground. You have one session that handles all of your physicality. Mm-hmm. You do middle drill. You do pass rush one-on-ones. You do team versus team, ones versus ones. You do your Oklahoma drill. You hit. And then your next practice should be fundamentals and learning period. Right. And that's where you install. That's where you go through certain things, checks, calls. You run your offense against a defense that you'll probably see the first few weeks of the season. And they most coaches did a good job of separating that. So my concern was, because we're getting away from more contact before the season anyway.
Yeah.
Which you and I have talked about has impacted things early in the season from a blocking and tackling perspective. My concern was, well, if you're only giving these guys one chance to get on the practice field every day, now they're going to try to compress everything into that practice. Mm-hmm. Try to get all the hitting in, all the physicality in, and then try to go learn at the same time. So you're almost taken away from everything, so to speak, in a little bit of everything. So
no, that's all good stuff. That's debatable stuff. And, you know, you'll get 10 coaches in the room. You have 10 different viewpoints.
Sure,
and that's all debatable stuff. For me, we were able to spend the time being educators. You know, there's a lot to teach in football.
Absolutely.
And so, again, I'm a believer in managing situations. I feel like if we can win the battle of situational football, we'll have an advantage over our opponents. And so what you end up with, since I can only practice once a day, I got the rest of the day to teach in the classroom. I can walk through. You know, we can find some space in a dorm parking lot, or, you know, in a classroom building, and move the chairs and be able to walk through different scenarios and teach guys what to expect. And then tomorrow, when we get our 2 hours of actual practice time, then we can physically put them through those paces. I think it helps with the learning curve, if you ask me. That's just my opinion.
I want to give you a chance, when you mentioned your offense and learning, to talk about Jordan Bentley. He's been named to the 2017 watch list for the Black College Football Player of the Year Award. When you talk about building an offense, to have someone like this young man is affording you a great luxury to be able to start right there with him and then sort of build everything around him.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's exactly right. And when we recruited the kid, to be honest with you, we were thinking that he was that kind of player. I mean, I still don't get it. Well, how come nobody else saw what we saw? I thought I was wrong. And anyway, make a long story short, fast forward to now, and you have a guy who we absolutely want to build this program around him. And so what you do is you go out and you recruit a quarterback who can distribute the football so that the pressure is not on Jordan to carry the team. You find a guy here or there who can help you in other ways to stretch the defense from sideline to sideline so that you can open up seams in the middle for Jordan. And then you find offensive linemen and tight ends who can complement what he does. And what a source of pride for those guys. You and I played on the front. And, you know, getting a 100-yard game was a prideful thing for us, or you know, whatever the standard was. And to have a Jordan Bentley be your bell cow, I mean, and everybody can take pride in the fact that he might be the outstanding player in HBCU football. I mean, that's something that we will definitely build on as a football team, and it'll be a motivator week in and week out.
I don't know how much this has impacted your football team, but we seemingly talk about it more and more every week, every year that we've been doing radio. And I just want to get your opinion on, as a collegiate head football coach, how the word transfer is now impacting the game. Mm. How do you view it, and how has it affected you as a coach?
It's a difficult process. It really is. There's so many layers to this transfer thing. And I can only, you know, really kind of speak to my personal experience here at Alabama A&M. It's not an easy thing to have a transfer student get in and matriculate successfully. You know, we have these rules that we have to abide by. He has to bring in a percentage. He has to bring in a certain GPA. And, you know, it's tough to make sure a guy checks off all those boxes. It's really not an easy part of the thing. But when you talk about a guy who comes in and he's ready to contribute right now, you don't have to develop him. I mean, it's a necessary evil in what we do. You've got to go out and get transfers to fill those gaps that are left by maybe a guy decided he didn't love football anymore, or, you know, he graduated, or whatever the case might be, and you need a guy to come fill those gaps. That's what, in my opinion, that's what transfers are designed for, okay, if I could use that term. Otherwise, you build your program from ground up. You bring a guy in as a freshman, you redshirt him, you build him, and he's your guy for 4 years. But there's so many layers with the transfer thing. It's such a necessary thing. But at the same time, I just don't know if it's, you know, if that's what you want to build your program on. And so we try to minimize it as much as we can. But we're gonna have the benefit of some transfer kids at our place right now, and I'm pretty happy to have them.
Well, and you're seeing some smaller school kids now graduate.
Yeah.
And then want to go play at a bigger school. I mean,
Casey
Dunn
from Jacksonville
State. So you're talking about
the graduate transfer.
Both. I'm talking about all of it, okay. Really all of it. You know, Auburn's got a center that's graduated from Jacksonville State who would have started there. Mm-hmm. He's probably not going to start at Auburn, but I assume he just wanted to go be on an SEC football team for a year, and he was afforded that opportunity. So it's just it works a lot of different ways, and I often tell Arky how when I played football, the word transfer was a death wish.
Yeah.
You never resurfaced.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can count on one hand the guys from any schools that I remember leaving one school and resurrecting their career at another school and really having success. I mean, you transferred for a reason. And you either flunked out of school or you got kicked out of school, and then nobody wanted you.
That's right. That's right. And then here's another tough thing about it. You know, you have a system. Everybody has a system. Everybody has a process that they take their football team through. And if you get a guy he transfers, he's maybe got three years left, or he's got 2 years left as a transfer. By the time you get him indoctrinated to your way of doing things, he's used a year and he's only got a year left, or 2 years left, or depending on when he transfers. And so, is it worth it? You know, that's always the question. Is it going to be worth us putting the time into getting this guy ready, and we're only going to get 1 year out of him?
Absolutely.
Or putting the time and effort into getting this guy, and then he may never pan out. I mean, there's a little bit of a crapshoot involved. So,
Coach Spady, great stuff as always. Appreciate the time. Best of luck this season. We'll talk to you again before it gets kicked off. Back with more Cube Show and Vegas Runner right after this. Welcome back in, Cube Show, Sports Radio 730 and 1039 The Ump. Listen online, umpsports.com. Right here in the Southern RV Wholesale Studio. Go to srvwholesale.com. Vegas Runner joins us now. He's with us every Thursday at this time. Good morning, Vegas Runner. How are you?
Never better. Busy time, man. Real busy time right now in Vegas. Week two of the preseason kicks off tonight. Last week, Wise Guys had a really good week one of the preseason. Not surprising. I expect them to have a really good NFL season and college football season. If you remember last year, the final month, 2 months, the books had a really terrible football season. One of the months that they really didn't do well, I remember December and January. And most sharps came into this season thinking that the books were going to had to sprinkle in a little more of public perception into the betting lines than they did last season. Seems like they've done that early on, and that's benefited sharps. Also, quickly, college football, Alabama continues to attract the most money to win the national championship, but Michigan and Ohio State continue to attract the most betting volume, meaning the most tickets, even though Alabama's attracting the most money. And finally, a lot of NFL and college football win totals have been bet on over the last 10-plus days by a couple betting syndicates, along with week one NFL and college football lines. And, of course, McGregor-Mayweather, they went to 8-ounce gloves. Shocking. Everyone out here was really shocked that Nevada State Athletic Commission allowed for it. Since they're fighting at 154 pounds, yet they did, and somehow the narrative out there is that this somehow benefits Conor McGregor so much that the sharp books, even offshore, have now dropped the line to as low as Mayweather minus 500, which is making the sports books out here a little bit nervous, because they had confidence in the fact that the sharp offshore books still had Mayweather up around minus 600. So they found comfort in that, believing that they were protecting themselves offshore against the big guys that wanted to bet Mayweather, who possibly have credit and were going to bet early. They didn't do that because it was minus 600 offshore. Now that it's minus 500, books here are starting to worry, uh-oh, maybe that big wise guy money isn't going to come in since it's down to 500 and it's not coming in. And if it doesn't, they're going to have so much risk on McGregor. It arguably could be one of the worst results if the kid pulled off the miracle.
Do you believe that the lighter gloves give one side or the other a true advantage?
Yeah, honestly, I think they benefit Floyd Mayweather, and this has nothing to do with the narrative that I agree with, that Mayweather's going to win the fight. It's just the fact that of his 49 wins, I believe almost all of them came with 8-ounce gloves. That's what he's used to using. The fact that Mayweather wants the 8-ounce gloves when he already had the green light for 10-ounce gloves shows me just how confident he really is, because if he had any concern of the power of McGregor, the 10-ounce gloves would have been Floyd's benefit. He would have never allowed that to happen. And since he's the A-side, it wouldn't have happened. And the fact he's allowing it to happen shows me just how confident he is in being able to handle McGregor's punch and power, and just how he believes unskilled McGregor is. The lesser gloves will allow Floyd, I think, to do more damage than he would have. So I think it benefits Mayweather, believe it or not, more than McGregor, who's used to 4-ounce gloves. So regardless, if he goes to 8 or 10, it's going to be really different for him. So I don't see how the narrative is it benefits McGregor. I guess because the belief is he's the bigger puncher, so it makes those that believe McGregor has a shot into believing it more now. So, you know, it goes with the narrative of the McGregor has a shot, I guess, and that's why the line's dropping. But, again, I think it's just a misinterpretation of the data once again.
Well, how does the data look? Ezekiel Elliott nearly a week away from being suspended. He's going to, for 6 weeks since he's been suspended. He's going to appeal. Got to have that heard within 10 days. If the 6 games does hold up, how does that affect the future odds for the Cowboys over under for the win total and for their Super Bowl odds?
Yeah, great question. Here's the thing with season win totals. Books don't want to move them too much off the opening line. Instead, what they like to do is add vig. And what that means is if a team season win totals is 8, and all of a sudden sharp money starts coming in on the over 8, instead of going to 8.5 season win totals or 9, they'll make you have to lay 150, 160, 180 to win 100 on the over 8 rather than moving the number, because that puts them in a position where they could get middled. Remember, NFL, they only play 16 games. Each game is about 7.5% of the entire schedule. So it tells you how every half-game increment they move it opens the door for them to get middled. We have seen this season they moved a couple games, season win totals, half a season win, but they haven't done that with the Dallas Cowboys. Instead, they adjusted the vig. Cowboys' season win total was 9.5 with the over favored. Now with the Ezekiel Elliott situation, the under 9.5 favored. So it hasn't changed the season win total. What we have seen change is their odds to win the Super Bowl have obviously gone from 10-1 to around 15-1, and that drops the odds on the Eagles, Washington, and the Giants. Because remember, future pulls are kind of like parimutuel in horse racing. As money comes in on one horse, the odds on another horses go up, kind of like the same with the futures. As the Dallas win futures, now they go from 10-1 to 15-1. Other teams that were maybe, you know, 12-1 will go down to 10-1, teams like the Eagles or what have you. So that's where it's affected that, not much. But on the game-by-game basis, this is what's beautiful about sports betting. Most odds makers will quantify that Ezekiel Elliott's worth around 0.5 to the betting line. And remember, I always say maybe about a dozen non-quarterbacks are worth that much to the betting line. Very few players could affect the betting line that are non-quarterbacks. Most think Ezekiel's worth around 0.5. Some have argued he's worth a point and a half. That's the beauty of sports betting. Odds makers, bookmakers, they put out a number. After that, we, the market, decide where the number goes. And with Ezekiel Elliott, that's what we're going to see. Those that believe that the market's overreacting are going to find value in Dallas. Those that think they haven't given Zeke his due are going to see value against Dallas. So, I mean, the sports books are kind of playing it like that. Let's see what the market does with it. And so far, as the futures market goes, wise guys haven't looked to take advantage of it, either has the betting public. Remember, you know, as big of a stud as he is and as much of the offense as he is for Dallas, you know, running backs just don't have that clout that they did, you know, years ago. You know, it's running back by committee. You know, it's just a different type of game that they play. And because of that, you're not seeing the value that I think the recreational bettors expected, you know, the market to think that Zeke was worth to Dallas. And we haven't seen, you know, that much of an adjustment made.
Great stuff, Vegas Runner. Always appreciate the time. Look forward to catching up next week.
Thanks for having me. Enjoy the games.
Vegas Runner joins us every Thursday. Before we go to break, want to tell you about our friends at Valley Equipment Rental. Head over to valleyequipmentrents.com, valleyequipmentrents.com, or call Russ and Tanner and the guys today at 256-964-6081, 964-6081, and they're going to help you out with tillers, pressure washers, stump grinders, and more. All the equipment that you need, either for your construction site or for just a little home project around the yard. Valley Equipment Rental at valleyequipmentrents.com. Call 964-6081 or stop by 3551 South Memorial Parkway today. Over $1 million in brand new equipment that's waiting for you to go in and choose what's best for you. Ross and Tanner are going to help you out as well. Valley Equipment Rental, back with more Cube Show next.